Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes and James Moffitt, and this is another two-hour session on Zero Point Radio Show. We explore esoteric and mystical psychology and science, as well as have discussion on contemporary social and political issues. I have a website at www.zeropoint.ca, and I have a wide selection of my writings, articles, and chapters from my books up on my site, so I encourage people to have a look at my website. And I have links there to, you can buy through Amazon my newly printed book called The Heart Doctrine, which I would say is the most important of my works, exploring mystical views of the origin and nature of human consciousness. And the Heart Doctrine book argues that modern science for the past century or longer has made fundamental mistakes in thinking that consciousness and the mind are only up in the head or produced by the brain. And I call that the Head Doctrine. And modern science and psychology doesn't think that a human being has an I, like the letter I. They don't think a human being has a singular I in any way. Instead, we're a pack of neurons or a pack assembly of molecules. That a human being has no real I. And in contrast to that, what the Heart Doctrine book explores is the teaching that you find in all different of the world's religions and in different mystical teachings, that the true origin of human consciousness and the I experience originates out of the heart. It's not produced by the material brain in the head, but it emerges out of the heart. And to say that consciousness emerges from the heart doesn't mean that consciousness is only in the heart. That's not the point of that I'm trying to express. But rather, consciousness from the heart is distributed through the subtle anatomy and through the actual physical blood in the physical body. So the consciousness can be all through the body. It's not only located up in the mind, in the head, but we can be conscious of ourselves all through our body. And it's related to the blood flow, and it's related to the heart. And in mystical teachings, they depict human beings as having some essential I that's connected to the heart. In the Hinduism or in yoga, it's called the Jiva Atma, the individual self. And both the Jiva Atma and the Paramatma, which means the infinite supersoul, are both connected to the heart in Vedic teachings. Lord Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all beings. So in mystical teachings, the true I is under our noses all the time, within the heart, and the experience or attainment of the state of true self-consciousness involves the opening of the heart center, or what Gurdjieff calls the higher emotional center. And the self within the heart is described as inherently self-illuminating, like the sun. In the outer world, the sun is inherently self-illuminating. It's its own source of radiant light. Similarly, mystics depict the Jiva Atma, or the divine spark within the heart, as inherently self-illuminating. And it's the light of the self is taken as being of the nature of consciousness. That consciousness is light that illuminates us within the inner world. So that's why when people experience enlightened states of consciousness, there's that experience of light, and you can experience being flooded with light and you can experience all these subtle energies and light energies. So the idea is that consciousness is connected to light. But in the mystics explained that in the normal conditions of life on the planet, people, in a way, they don't know their true selves, and they form a false self, which is a persona. And the word persona comes from Greek, and it means a mask. And the actors would have a persona, which was a face on a stick, and they would put that over their own face, and they would assume that character in the play. Well, similarly, we all have a persona or a personality, which is that part of ourselves which is formed not as a consequence not only of what we inherently are as a being, but also as we're shaped and conditioned by our environment. So as a person grows up, the idea in an infant, the essential consciousness is still centered in the heart. But as an adult grows up, more and more we become dominated by the persona or false ego connected to the mind in the head. And Gurdjieff says that what happens is that our essential consciousness passes into the unconscious. And instead, he describes human beings as forming what he calls a false consciousness system, which is this whole system of conditioning and that we acquire from outside of ourselves. So the idea is that we have to get back to this essential consciousness. Aleister Crowley calls he talks about the child consciousness of the heart. So we have to awaken in this experience of the heart, and the awakening the heart then can fill you with light, and that light can illuminate you and illuminate the higher centers, so you can have experiences of higher faculties related to the higher centers. But in yoga, it's taught that all the states of samadhi, they're based upon an awakened heart. And then beyond that, there's different levels and experiences of samadhi or mystical states that a person might experience. But the next step in human evolution, see, Gurdjieff says, in life, most people are in a state of waking sleep, so that we're kind of conscious and we go about our lives and react to things and function generally appropriately to the world. But we're not truly conscious of ourselves. Instead, we're so conditioned, and we become so ruled by habits of the mind and emotions and physical habits. So we have to recover this essential self-experience, which he says is based on the essence. The essence is what you are in your being, whereas your personality is what's acquired from outside of yourself. So we have to get back to this essential consciousness which has passed into our subconscious. And if we can do that, then that helps to illuminate us inwardly so that we can be enlightened, which might occur to varying levels on different levels and even on different planes. Okay, so through the Zero Point program, we explore these consciousness studies and the work of mystics ranging from Gurdjieff to Blavatsky to Kabbalistic teachings to Sufism and Christianity and Judaism. So we draw upon a wide range of mystical teachings and trying to relate it particularly to the issues of consciousness and also trying to understand creation. What mystics say about the nature of creation of the universe and the creation of life. And today we're going to pick up on a second part of studies of the secret doctrine of Madame Blavatsky. So we'll pick up that later in the show and introduce my co-host, and we can have some other discussions here for a while, and then today later we'll discuss mystical views of creation based on the secret doctrine. Okay, Jim, are you there?
I'm here. Yeah, hi, Chris.
Yeah, welcome. Nice day there.
Oh, gorgeous. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's gorgeous here too.
Beautiful weather lately, and yeah, it's nice because we had a real spell of cold for a while, you know. So it's nice to get outside and not have to put jackets and heavy clothes on.
Yeah.
Sit outside, enjoy it, enjoy the sun.
Boy, this is such a catastrophe, environmental catastrophe. This, I don't even know the word for it because they use the word oil spill on TV, but it's not an oil spill. There's an open gusher of oil.
The oil is
gushing out of the earth.
It is a spill, but it isn't, like you say. I mean, there's such intense pressure there that this oil is just surging out of the earth, essentially. And the environmental damage is catastrophic. But I mean, I hope that to a certain extent that this wakes people up to, you know, I mean, Obama has approved offshore drilling and again and again. I mean, that the signs are obvious that, you know, we're not going to get rid of oil as a fuel for a long time, but we are eventually going to run out of oil, and the need to explore alternate energies and to be more efficient in terms of managing our consumption of energy is of paramount importance. I mean, this is like the effect of this is just extraordinary on the ecology and on the economy. I mean, it just affects every aspect of life for people in a huge area. So it's very unfortunate. But as I say, if there's any kind of a silver lining or a positive in this, is that this has wake people up. Is that these guys, you know, they do things to get this oil, and they'll stop at basically nothing. And you know, this isn't like this is some sort of oddity. This happens. I mean, it's a scale that's odd because it's so huge, and it's posed such problems for them to bring it under control. But the bottom line is that everything we use in terms of energy involves a cost. You know, we have to start to be a lot smarter about what costs we're prepared to pay. And you know, you see it, like I say, it's an ecological disaster, but it's an economic disaster too, because, you know, ultimately everything that we do on this planet depends on the health of the planet itself. I mean, nothing comes for free. You can't spend your way out of this. It's extraordinarily bad situation.
It's such a complex situation. Like, on the one hand, I think there are existing technologies that would make it so we didn't need the oil, but I think that such technologies have existed and are available and have been for a long time. So I think in ways this has all been a scam, that we are so dependent and that's the only alternative. But it's, besides from that, I think it's most tragic for those people who live along that part of the country, and it must have been so beautiful and to lose that whole lifestyle and what it means to America, and then as you say, like the fish stock and this oil gusher. Like, if they are unable to stop this, if it continues at the rate that it's releasing oil, this could spread. I mean, they're saying it can go up the East Coast, and then it get caught in the Gulf Stream and into the Atlantic. It's absolutely terrible. And the other thing that is so shocking is you see these lowlands now, which have already been destroyed, some of them, by the oil. And it's like these people had a month to act, And they knew this huge mass of oil was coming. Like, why didn't they act immediately? And they were, I watched some of the CNN coverage, and you just saw some of the people from the state of Louisiana, and they were just pleading, at every point they've been blocked, and they have all these proposals, and nothing gets done.
There was something on the CBC on The Current on the other morning where they had all these different people with all sorts of different solutions, you know, and measures to contain the oil. And all of them proposed, you know, very interesting proposals, different things. And then they had some people on. They were asking them, well, how realistic are these? And they said, well, they're all realistic. You know, people aren't making this stuff up. But it's, again, you get into this whenever there's a disaster the size, you get into all sorts of jurisdictional disputes, and you get foot dragging by the people who are going to have to pay for it. You know, I was like, I don't know what British Petroleum is doing for all this, but you know, I mean, there's just so many different aspects to it. But meanwhile, you know, everything is being coated in oil, and it's destroying all these things. And as you say, these people, you know, whose lives depend upon this land and these waters, you know, that they're begging for help. I mean, it's eerily similar to Katrina in terms of, like, just complete inaction by people who, you know, who have responsibility to deal with these things. It's very disturbing, you know.
Yeah, I know. And some other things, like most disturbing things that I've heard recently on the Truth Networks, like some... I mean, there, it's, I think people in the Truth Networks really think we're being lied to a lot about what's actually happening, and there's a question of whether this was another false flag terrorist thing that's self-inflicted, like that's done through sabotage. And there's actually, you know, there's these reports of these shorts being placed by Goldman Sachs on BP, the same as you had on 9/11, where there were shorts placed on the airlines. That was one thing. And there's this email that surfaced from someone at Goldman Sachs telling someone that they'd put these shorts on these the oil thing, and if there was some big accident, they'd be rolling in money. And I've read this email. It's a shocking email.
Well,
apparently,
at this point, I wouldn't discount anything involving criminal activities of these people, but I think it's likely it was an accident. I mean, there's certainly no shortage of these things that have happened. I mean, it's one of the inherent dangers associated with the oil industry, you know, is that it does leak and things do happen. I mean, you know, drilling oil wells is a very tricky proposition. But as I say, I wouldn't out of hand discount any of this just because there's such extensive criminal activity amongst these guys who will do anything to make a buck that it wouldn't entirely shock me if something was exposed. But I'll sort of leave that open for now. But I mean,
exactly.
It's not out of the realm of possibility. Let's put it that way. Like, you know, as horrible.
I mean, if they can do 9/11, then something like this is. I mean, this is even more catastrophic, I think, in terms of its implications.
Well,
I mean,
it
far greater.
Maybe not. When you start thinking all the people that have died as a result of 9/11 since 9/11, I mean, beyond the, you know, the implications of the disaster. I mean, we've had a couple of wars because of this, and all sorts of criminal activities. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's hard to kind of fathom. You'd have to really understand the implications of all this for people. But it's clearly, it's a major disaster. And as they say, if any good can come of this, I hope that it will wake people up to the fact that just can't go on. You know, where essentially the oil and gas and coal companies, you know, big energy, and have such incredible power and are, you know, have such influence on policy making, and as you say, suppressing alternatives or you know, denying money to be paid to alternative energy sources and just, you know, different technologies that could, you know, drastically reduce our dependence on oil and gas and coal, you know, and that's,
yeah. Did you ever see the videos of that fellow Stan Myers who had that working prototype car that ran on water?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you did. They like
yeah.
That would be unbelievable.
Yeah,
right?
I know.
He said he could go coast to coast in that on 22 gallons of water. So all you'd have to do every now and then, you'd have to stop by a river or get water or
water
take
station.
Water with you.
Yeah, or a water station. Instead of pumping gas, you just pump water.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, well, there's all sorts of things. I mean, even like with Tesla, you know, who was interested in developing the energy from the Earth as a standing wave. Like, he thought that energy grid could be tapped into, and that you could have sort of like relay stations all over the world and use the Earth's inherent energy itself. You know, like, and he was, you know. He was ostracized. I mean, he was a pretty strange guy on a whole variety of levels, but he had greater plans than just simply making money. Like, Edison is sort of the bete noire of all this, and Edison is his rival, you know, was very much interested in making as much money as possible for himself. I mean, the whole history of the 20th century, I guess, is like there's all sorts of things out there. You know, that guy that we had on the show a couple of years ago from New Zealand, in his book has, I'm trying to think of his name, The Suppressed...
John Eisen.
Yeah, Jonathan Eisen.
Jonathan Eisen.
He has some very interesting material in his book. That's a very interesting book, actually. And,
I read that.
You know, I guess at the end of the day, there's just... When you have forces that have so much money and have so much, and there are other forces that have so much invested in having the economy run in a certain way on certain principles and to, you know, to feed certain sectors of the economy, it's so difficult to, you know, to overcome that power. And I guess that in a lot of ways, that's where people sort of opting out and doing things on their own is the real alternative, you know. And that's one of the advantages of the internet, is that you can provide information, you can provide technological information to people if they want to try to do things differently. You know, like, there are people who get off the electric grid themselves, you know, and I mean, there are different possibilities. There's lots of possibilities.
Well, I mean, there's a worldwide community of people waking up to the seriousness of our situation. I think, like, people in Europe now, they kind of see... In a way, you know, the people of Greece and Iceland, how these people wake up and it's like the wealth of their country's been kind of stolen by these international bankers, kind of. And people are realizing this around the world more and more, like, you know, and angry about it. You know, our countries have been controlled by these interbreeding and interrelated networks of criminal offenders, you know.
Well, there's a thing coming up here. The G8 and the G20 summits are coming up here in Canada, in Toronto and north of Toronto and Muskoka. And the bill is going to be, for security, is already over, it's almost $1 billion. It's going to be in excess of $1 billion for these people to come together to have these conferences to talk about economic problems and economic realities. Meanwhile, in Canada, we're told we don't have any money for daycare. We don't have any money, to help the poor. We don't have any money to build a better healthcare system. Oh, but we got $1 billion for these knobs to come together so we can provide security for them. And they, you know, pick up a phone and have a teleconference, you idiots. You know, all they want to do is have a bunch of photo opportunities and come out and make a bunch of ridiculous, you know, platitudinous statements about how their cooperation is growing, blah, blah, blah. You know, the same malarkey that's going to lead to absolutely nothing, and it's going to cost the Canadian taxpayers more than $1 billion for, quote-unquote, security, you know, to protect these idiots. And it's like, come on. It's like, it's just, you know, it's just so disgraceful, it's laughable, but, you know, and I think it's actually good in this case, because people are really quite outraged by this. They realize how completely preposterous this is. There's quite a backlash growing in Canada. Not that it's gonna do anything, but you see that they have four of these machines that emit this high frequency noise to control demonstrators. So it's like these machines emit this noise and disperse crowds. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, the sound cannons.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, they're supposed to be.
I wish I had one of those.
Yeah, if they returned them on the real terrorists, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah.
You know, if all of a sudden the police.
I drive up to Parliament Hill and let go, you know, and they have them all run out of the building. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's such a, you know, as I say, it's so bizarre when, on the one hand, oh, we don't have any money, but somehow they have $1 billion for security.
Yeah.
Security. I mean,
and as though there's all these kind of criminal elements here in Canada, kind of among us people who want to do anything violent, eh? Whenever they have their own agent provocateurs, who, because so many of the incidents of what do happen, it's their own people, you know? It's their own people who stage things and get things going. Like, that's what happened up at Montebello. The only trouble the whole time was their own cops who kind of came in. I was there.
Yeah.
I saw these guys come into on the road where the protests were. You could see just when they were coming into the crowd, I could see, these guys are weirded out. And they kind of like, they just looked like thugs, you know, and they had like rocks in their hands, things like that. And right away, like everybody else in the protest was like just normal people with families and children and grandparents and, you know. And then like here are these guys who stand out like they're thugs. And then they have this incident with the police and then they escape into the police lines to escape the people, and then people see that they got on the same boots as all the other cops, kind of, you know? And it's just like last week we had a bombing in Ottawa, which is being blamed on natives because of the Olympics and the land, and I just see it's another complete false flag. I don't believe it. It's like I don't believe the news anymore. They're just such pathological liars and deceivers, you know?
Yeah.
And this Gulf thing, I saw a very disturbing little video of a news report on TV yesterday, which I don't know what to make of this yet. But there was two, like, experts, oil and environmental experts, and this one fellow was saying, he was saying that what we're seeing, like if you watch CNN, which is what I've been watching, and you have videos of this oil escaping, he says that's not the main leak at all, and he says that there's some other major leak, but he described it as 6 miles from the site that they're focusing on. And he said he viewed this from an airplane, and it was a shocking report. I don't know what to make of it yet. We'll have to see over time. You know, maybe there's a lot more to this. And
you never know. And, that's
no,
point.
You don't. We don't. You know.
Don't know. I mean, yeah. It would be very interesting. Actually, I think I may have. I heard something about that the other day, but I wasn't really paying attention. It was kind of in this whole coverage on CBC Radio, because I think they actually talked to that guy, but I was sort of distracted, so I didn't really capture the gist of it. But he had, that's what I thought, was that he said, well, it actually might not be what, you know, is being reported, that there's something more to this than meets the eye, which is...
Yeah, it was shocking.
I might explain why it's so hard for them to stop this,
Well, I don't know what their advantage would be to deceive us about what was causing it. I mean, I don't know what to make of that report, because what he was saying, that the site of the main gusher, he thought, from judging where the plumes were from an airplane or a helicopter, he thought it was 6 miles, I think he described it, to the southeast of where the rig is. So, I mean, if that was it, well, I mean, BP, you would think, would be pointing over there. It's not that. It's
well,
there. I mean, it's all very, you know, I really don't understand. And then there are other reports that people are saying, like, one of the most dangerous thing here is the possible methane gas, being released out of this oil and how it interacts with these things that these toxic chemicals they added, the dispersants that took the oil down to the bottom, which was like the worst thing to do.
You know what the dispersants consist of? I mean, it's largely it's antifreeze.
Oh yeah, yeah, is that?
Yeah, which
yeah,
is,
apparently,
you know, if you want your cat or dog to die, you know, let them drink out of a puddle but there's antifreeze in it because it'll kill them, you know. I mean, it's very toxic. The solution is part of the problem basically. That's one of the realities that there's no easy way to stop this or to clean this up Short-term gains may actually involve, you know, huge long-term losses for people because this will have a further toxicity effects in making the environment even more toxic and spread through the entire food chain, which is, you know, very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like there's an assault on the people of the United States from almost every angle, eh?
Is Don trying to talk to us? Are you getting that? I don't know if you're getting that, because I sort of heard Don, but I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't hear anything.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, anyway, so, boy, we'll just have to see. I just think it's very ominous, and this is something, it's like, you know, it's not going to go away by not considering it. It's just getting into a bigger and bigger problem, and then all of a sudden it's going to be on the coast, you know, of
yeah.
The Florida and then up the East Coast, and I don't know. I feel the people of the United States are being assaulted on every possible angle. You know, the country's being impoverished, and all this money's put into these criminal wars, and it's just so tragic what's happening around the planet. I mean, you just see the troubles in North Korea and South Korea, and there was maybe another staged event.
Yeah,
and,
I don't know to trust that. That sounds completely realistic to me that this is staged. Eh? It's like, like a real history of that. Eh? It's like, I don't trust any of that. It's all bullshit as far as I'm concerned. Like, you know, a lot of the reporting about this and, you know, the whole hysteria about North Korea, I think, is completely ludicrous, you know. overreacting. Just switching topics for a second. I know that you quote Sri Ramana Maharshi at different times in your writings, but have you actually ever read much of his questions and answers with his pupils or know anything about him?
Yeah, I've read a number of smaller booklets published on him and by his students. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just starting to read, a book called Be As You Are on the teachings of Sri Ramana Maharshi, edited by David Godman. And, very interesting, just at the beginning explaining how when he was a schoolboy, he had this, experience where he was, overwhelmed by the terror that he was dying and had a sort of a simulated death experience, and then realized that after he had gone through this that even if his body died that his self is imperishable, and it sort of transformed his whole being. And then he left his parents and he went to northern India and essentially became a holy man in northern India never really regained any sense of himself as an individualized human being. It's like it's very interesting at the beginning of this book where they just sort of explain his near-death experience and then how it transformed him and how his experience of real self led him to realize that there was just this pure consciousness, which is the reality behind everything. And he has different names for it. He calls it the self, and he calls it the guru, and he calls it the heart. But it's this essential consciousness, which is behind everything, which is the source of everything. And he went to this this mountain, Aranchala, in northern India, and the author says the choice of Aranchala was far from random. Throughout his brief life, Maharshi had always associated the name of Aranchala with God, and it was a major revelation to him when he discovered that it was not some heavenly realm, but a tangible earthly entity. The mountain itself had long been regarded by Hindus as a manifestation of Shiva, and in later years, Venkataram Raman, which is his original Maharshi's original name, often said it was the spiritual power of Arunachala, the mountain, which had brought about his self-realization. His love for the mountain was so great that from the day he arrived in 1896 until his death in 1950, he could never be persuaded to go more than 2 miles away from its base. I thought that was really, I mean, it's an amazing story. That's the first two pages of this book, but that he felt it was the mountain itself. And it's like, kind of like when you discuss with guys in South America that the natives, people who believed that where they were was the heart of the world, and it's just like another individual who has this experience of realization of self and says it's the actual spiritual power of the mountain which gave him that experience.
Yeah, wow, what a fascinating story. And I mean, he's one of the most authentic, I would say, of all like mystical spiritual writers. And
yeah, on the back of this book, and this again, it goes to what we were talking about a few weeks ago about, I quoted Jacob Needleman when he said that, you know, that he found this authority in Gurdjieff's speeches that he read when he began learning about the fourth way. On the back of this book, there's a quote from Parabola about Maharshi, and it says, that sense of presence of the direct communication of the truth, so far as it can be put into words, is there on every page. That's talking about this book, and like his whole thing was that he didn't teach very much by speaking. It was by direct his presence on its effects on people. That he felt that whenever he put things in words, he was stepping the truth down. He would still have dialogues with people. That's why there's this book, but he felt that the real experience was beyond words and could only really be translated directly from him to other people. And which raises a really interesting question about, and what little I know of him, I think he was really one of these genuine, as you say, one of the truly genuine spiritual figures. It raises this whole question that it's interesting whenever people who talk about religion and the so-called new atheists, when they talk about religion as an illusion or a delusion, and they never ever deal with the existence of all these people throughout human history, these realized spiritual figures. They never really talk about, well, they never talk about their ideas, but they never talk about how these people have existed throughout human history and how these people have had such a palpably realized higher essence that everyone who surrounds them speaks about it and has the same opinion of it, like authenticates it to the extent that it can be extended, authenticated externally. And that these people, you know, that the people are described as, like with Gurdjieff, is that he would transmit, he told people to draw on his Handbladzoin, which was the energy of the astral body, and he said that he had more of this energy than he himself needed, and he could give it to other people. And there are various descriptions of Gurdjieff helping people by transmitting this energy to people. And you know, there are different names for it in different spiritual disciplines, but this whole idea of entering into the spiritual spiritual aura of a real teacher has been expressed throughout history, and yet there's never any discussion of this in these people who criticize religion or who deny the reality of spiritual realities and deny the validity of any religious teachings. And I was thinking the other day, you know, it's kind of that's an idea that's kind of fallen. Well, I'm not sure it was really that well established in the West, but it certainly has been dismissed by Western thinkers since the age of the Enlightenment, is that everything was reduced to the power of reason and the intellect, and that which couldn't be reasoned or couldn't be expressed in rational thought was regarded as being unreal or delusional or fanciful or imaginative or magical thinking, and dismissed kind of a priori as having no real reality. But I was thinking the other day, it takes a real act of intellectual denial to survey the course of human history and to just deny that these people exist. You know, I mean, they exist throughout history and over again in every epoch and in every age and every culture and every part of the globe. There have been these people who others have regarded as you know, as being spiritually developed to the point that they actually had some sort of an aura or some sort of a presence that could transmit these energies and could transmit these higher religious feelings and impulses to others. So, and yet there's never any discussion of that.
Yeah, there isn't, and there's generally not discussion of the ideas that people articulated along
the way. Yeah,
I think one of the most interesting heart masters of our time has been Adi Da, and a lot his work was based on Ramana, influenced by Ramana. Adi Da is another person who seems to transmit the type of energy you're describing to his students or disciples, or I'm not sure what they're called. Have you read it? There's some fascinating accounts of people's experiences being with Adi Da when he kind of transmits his power to them and kind of sends them, helps them attain states of realization and such.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really quite fascinating. Some of the descriptions of people who were his pupils who were in his presence, and you'll find that was pretty much like I say, it's consistent throughout all of these different spiritual teachings, that is that the teacher generally, if somebody is a truly, I think that's the difference sort of between the pretenders and people who may have the outward appearance, and the genuine thing is that the genuine teacher always has this level of development that is, as I say, it's discernible to people who are with them, and is passed over. This energy is passed over to people and helps them to deal with problems and to have realizations of spiritual realities themselves.
Yeah. I mean, you look at pictures of Yogananda, he's like this beautiful mystical yogi saint. I mean, he just looks amazing, and you can see it in pictures of him.
Yeah.
And other saints in the Hindu tradition, and as you say, it is an enigma that's not really addressed by science or psychology.
You look at the eyes and the pictures of a guy like Hazrat Inayat Khan. His way, I mean, this guy looks like he's realized. It was like Henry Miller once said, you know, so I see these pictures of Gurdjieff. He says, man, does that guy look like a master? You know, it's like it just sort of is obvious when you look at them, you know, that these people have realized something. And then I remember there was a really interesting quote from C.S. Nott, who had studied with Gurdjieff at his institute in Paris in the 20s, and he said that just to be in Gurdjieff's presence was an experience. And he said, you know, that it's a known phenomenon that certain smaller electrical devices can be charged if they're in the presence of a larger electrical device. And he said that's what it was like with Gurdjieff, that he was blazing with this energy, and that it was palpable and you could feel it, like when you were around him and you gained energy from being in his presence.
Yeah, so many stories like that. I have this quote. I just dug out a quote from Ramana, which is one of the most beautiful quotes by him that's in the Heart Doctrine book. Mm-hmm. And it describes like this essential teaching about consciousness. He says, the effulgent light of active consciousness starts at a point and gives light to the entire body, even as the sun does to the world. When that light spreads out in the body, one gets the experiences in the body. The sages called the original point Hridayam, it's a Hindu term, the heart. Yeah, that's his special name for the heart, because he's not simply meaning the physical heart, but he's meaning the real heart center, which is like the spiritual heart center.
Yeah, is it spelled like HRI? Is that
Yeah, that's it. HRIDAYAM.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's his term for the heart, but it's the spiritual heart. He says the individual permeates the entire body with that light, becomes egocentric and thinks he is the body and that the world is different from him. The association of the self with the body is called the granti, or not.
Not, yeah.
When Atma, the self, alone shines within and without and everywhere, one is said to have severed the knot. Yeah, it's very profound teachings that he embodied.
Okay, so we got off. You were sharing some of your current reading. Oh, I've been reading an interesting book just to take us on another side. It's got a great quotation on the front cover by John Lennon. The book is David Icke's Guide to the Global Conspiracy. My goodness, what a researcher that fellow is, eh? His books are like, whoa, there's so much information and data, and he pulls it so much together. But anyway, has a great quote on the front cover by John Lennon. He says, our society is run by insane people for insane objectives. I think we're being run by maniacs for our maniacal ends, and I think I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that. That's what's insane about it. John Lennon. It was funny, when I read that, it reminded me of your old writings on Catch-22, which is, I always thought, a very brilliant kind of analysis. Why don't you just, for listeners not familiar, like Catch-22 was a Hellyer's book describing like the wartime conditions in France. And maybe you'd just explain like what Catch-22 was, I think. It's so like this quote from Lennon.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the idea is that Catch-22 is that you have to be crazy to fight in the war. Like Yossarian is a bombardier in a group of bombers that are stationed off. It's off Italy and he doesn't want to fly any more missions because he's afraid he's going to get killed. And Catch-22 says is that that if you're crazy, you can get out of flying more missions. You can get out of combat. But if you go to somebody and ask them to let you out of combat, that's the act of a sane mind. So therefore, you can't be crazy. But you have to be crazy to get out. So, but you have to be sane to ask. So like you're trapped by the catch. That's the catch, is that you know you can't get out of fighting the war, and Yossarian is sort of awakened to his to the reality of his situation and realizes that it's entirely crazy for him to keep on fighting, but as soon as he expresses that, he's sane, and therefore he has to go on fighting because now he's sane. And but you know, only if you're crazy can you get out. It's so bizarre. It's an inherent contradiction in a situation which is posed by the duality of the choices in which there's no third option. And that's what, in my opinion, that's what the book is that it's about is that the limits of reason and rationality when things are understood dualistic. Yossarian's friend keeps telling him that he should really fly with him, but Orr is a pilot, and Yossarian said, well, I don't want to fly with you. But he doesn't actually want to tell him he doesn't want to fly with him, but Orr keeps getting shot down, and Yossarian's afraid, well, if I fly with him, I'll get shot down and I'll get killed. But actually, Orr is practicing getting shot down because he intends to escape by getting shot down and then getting in a raft and rowing to Sweden, and that's what he does, which is entirely insane, but, you know, everybody else is practicing not getting shot down, and they're getting shot down and getting killed, and Orr is practicing getting shot down, and he doesn't get killed, and he escapes, eh? So that's kind of the, he's the, he's the or is the or is the other other way of looking at things. It's like he cooperates with the craziness of it all and ends up escaping from it.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. That's clever.
Well,
yes.
It's,
well, it's
whole,
like this thing of Lennon. It's like yeah, to be it, like to be sane in an insane world. It's like to say it's insane, which
yeah.
you'd say if you were sane. You'd realize, oh, this is insane. But then you're likely to be judged insane. And
totally, that's the problem.
Yeah. It amazes me sometimes. Like, why didn't any of these elites ever want to like truly serve humankind? Eh? Like, it's funny because when I was young, I always grew up, like, being generally supportive of the UN and the concept of, like, a world government that kind of stopped wars and mediated conflicts. And I was always in favor of that, like, generally as a world government, you know, aspects of that. But then what's happened is that the people who've arisen to the power in these organizations aren't humanitarian oriented, and the thing is all based on lies. Like, why weren't there a group of conscious elites, like, who were real benefactors to humankind? You know, what happened to them? Where'd they go?
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I'll come back to that. I just want to read you that there was only one catch, and that was catch 22, which specified that a concern for one's safety in the face of dangers that were real and immediate was the process of a rational mind, or was crazy and could be grounded. All he had to do was ask, and as soon as he did, he would no longer be crazy and would have to fly more missions. Or it would be crazy to fly more missions and sane if he didn't, but if he was sane, he had to fly them. If he flew them, he was crazy and didn't have to. But if he didn't want to, he was sane and had to. Yossarian was moved very deeply by the absolute simplicity of this clause of Catch 22 and let out a respectful whistle. That's some catch, that Catch 22, he observed. It's the best there is, Dr. Nika agreed. And that's it. It's like, that's kind of like, it's a perfect parable of, it's a perfect allegory about the situation of the individual in war, is that, you know, you're confronted with these insane choices and no escape from it. It's like, you know, in the double bind theory of schizophrenia, is that you know, parents place children in mutually contradictory situations, but not just that, but from which there's no escape, and that's what the double bind is. So it's not just that they're put in this situation, but they can't escape from it, and that's how you make schizophrenics, I mean, according to that theory. And that's kind of the world situation in a lot of ways, too. But back to your question about why don't these elites do something for the good. I mean, let's think about different types of elites. I mean, there's this whole idea about that there is an elite, and it is a conscious elite, and that there is an inner circle of humanity which does guide the world and which has provided needed resources and needed teachings and needed influences at different points in world history. And that's a very interesting question as to whether or not, you know, there is some sort of elite that we don't understand, which is like a force for good and for purity and for refinement and for consciousness and does consist of conscious beings. So, I mean, while there are malevolent elites bent on their own perverse and, you know, the very horrible intentions and plans for themselves and self-gratification, self-aggrandizement, there's also, I mean, the idea exists that there are this inner circle of humanity somewhere, perhaps not even on this realm, but that does provide these influences that we need, and it is committed to the good and to trying to help people to awaken.
Yeah, well, we sure need their help.
I think we desperately need their help, yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, one just doesn't know. I mean, I don't think I know. I have so many questions about, like, all that's really going on, you know, how to understand it. It's a huge mystery story. I think of the world situation, and I just think, in a way, like, it's beyond any novel that anyone has ever written or any movie. Like, it's just of such epic proportions. like the insanity of what became of modern times, the culture based on such lies, you know, like 9/11. I mean, you just think of that world event, and everything, you know, when you realize that's a lie, and then it helps unravel the whole kind of lie of what's become of our nations and the wars and so on.
Yeah,
I think this is a pivotal time in human history. You know, I feel this because I feel that the evidences against these people are becoming so widely spread through the world I don't know what our hope lies in. I mean, I think we need to spread the truth as much as we can in different ways, and we need people on the inside to turn. I feel like, I think sometimes, you know, when I developed an approach to working with criminal offenders when I worked in the prison system, and that was awakening of consciousness and the heart in criminal offenders. And I think, like, holy smokes, that's what we need on a worldwide level. Like, we need some of these criminal offenders, like, to wake up. Because, see, I think so many of them, they don't know what they're getting into when they get into the whole system. Like, they have no idea, really, of all the corruption of it. And then people get into positions where they just go along to get along, and because of their lifestyle and things like this. And then I think many people now are beginning to wake up, even on the inside, who realize, like, wow, this is terrible in a way. You know, we've betrayed our country. We've betrayed, you know, any semblance of moral character, you know. I heard a beep. I don't know if we had someone calling in.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been hearing.
Mark from Ohio.
Yeah, please, Mark. Go ahead.
I wondered if, Dr. Holmes, if you had gotten to hear of some of the information that Jay Widener has been talking about lately.
No, I haven't, but would you please go ahead and tell us, Mark?
Yeah, it kind of ties into the whole thing that's going on at the Gulf there, to a certain degree. It also ties in to the New World Order, to a degree. It's, some of the information is going to sound pretty outrageous in some ways, but the way Jay kind of lays it all out, it makes a lot of sense. He's been studying these ancient writings from India called the Puranas, and I guess these texts are from an oral tradition that goes back thousands of years, maybe even before the Vedic writings, and they tell about this fantastic story that the Earth goes through what's called the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and then the Iron Age. And the Iron Age is also called the Kali Yuga. And according to the Puranas, at the end of the Iron Age, the sun emits these giant coronal mass ejections that boil the oceans and light the forests on fire. So every 12,000 years, the sun has this burp, so to speak. And they know that 12,000 years ago, one of these ejections hit the United States and Canada area, and there was great forest fires, and there's, I guess, inches of ash in the soil. But anyway, according to Puranas, about, two kulpas ago, or two of these cycles, which I guess is about 120,000 years, there was a group that actually got off the Earth, and they built these giant arcs, and they went to a planet they call Mahar, which is really Mars, and then they spend, about 60,000 years underneath the surface of Mars, where they physically changed. They became very tall because of the lack of gravity, and their skin became very white, and they became, their hair is white or blonde, and their eyes became very large and blue or green. And then after the Earth starts to regenerate itself, they come back to the Earth. And according to Jay, this group is called the Vril, and they've also been called other names. The Nazis called them, I believe, the Vril, or they had other names for them, but supposedly they're tied up with the Rothschilds, and they're kind of the manipulators of the world today. And it's really kind of interesting the way Jay describes all this information. And he said that the Nazis in World War II were really working for the Vril, and they kind of manipulate the peoples of the earth and the civilizations of the earth to go through this big industrial age. And then there's a group of the earth people that they use to build these giant arcs. And then they eventually get off the planet before the next coronal mass ejection. So anyway, it's a really fascinating story. But I think it ties into the New World Order and to some of the strangeness. I know you were talking about just how bizarre things seem today. But anyway, I thought I would want to share that with you and see what you thought.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting, Mark, and I think I agree there's something like this behind this. Like, my tendency has been to think that there are vast under-earth empires in the earth. Like into the earth, that there are massive bases, and I think these people have bred with humans over. Like, I see there being some story like that, but the details of it, I mean, I'm very open to, you know, different possibilities. That's a fascinating story. I wasn't familiar with that.
Jay says these are what the Bible called the Nephilim, and that white people are kind of the bastard children of the Nephilim. We're kind of the offspring, so to speak, because the natural earth person is a dark-skinned person with dark hair, and these people, because they went off planet and lived underneath the ground on Mars, that they started to become kind of freakish-looking, and that's where the vampire myths come from. And they say their skin is so diaphanous that you can actually see the capillary system, and they live underneath the ground today, like you were saying, in some of these caves in Tibet and things like that.
Yeah, and are you familiar with the idea that there's this vast underground network of, they call them DUMs, deep underground military bases, and connected by tunnels? Are you familiar with that, Mark?
Yeah, you know, that's very interesting. What Jay is saying is that the managers of the New World Order have built these underground bases because they know from the Vril that these coronal mass ejections are coming. Now, Jay is saying that staying on the Earth underground may be still risky because sometimes these coronal mass ejections are so powerful that even being underground on Earth is not enough. But yes, I have heard of those deep underground bases.
Yeah, it's I think we have a mystery here, but I really do believe there is something alien behind these world elites, and I don't know. I thought at times that in Blavatsky's teaching, she has different rounds of life on Earth, and at one point there was Lemuria, and it was destroyed in Atlantis, and I've wondered about holdovers from previous rounds who might have lived under the earth and then developed underground. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's possible there are different aliens from different systems. Like, people talk about the Dracos and the Little Greys and the Big Greys and the Scandinavian type aliens, and it's a real mystery. We're in a mystery story.
You know, and it's funny, I believe that we've been visited by off-world cultures, but Jay says that these are actually the Vril, or these tall whites, whatever you want to call them, are actually Earth people that's like you said, had survived one of these previous ages. But when they were on Mars, they spent so much time underneath the ground of Mars that it actually kind of modified their bodies. And they have this look now that to us is very freakish looking. And they can't even stand the sunlight really anymore. They tend to only come out at night. But they have all that ancient technology you probably read about from the Vedic writings, the Vimanas and all that kind of technology. But it's a fascinating story, and I thought I would share that with you. He'd probably be a good one to get on your show if you could lasso him sometime and get some time from him.
Yeah, I would. How do you spell his last name? W-H-I-D-N-E-R?
W-E-I-D-N-E-R.
W-E-I-D...
N-E-R.
Okay.
J-Y-E-N.
I will...
It's E-I or I-E. Put that into YouTube, and you can watch some of his interviews there. But he ties in with... have you ever heard of Dr. Joseph Farrell?
No.
Oh, well, you should YouTube him, too. There are several researchers now that are kind of following this thread of information. Even Cliff High. Have you heard of Cliff High?
No, I haven't.
Well, gee, there you go. You could put all these names in, and you can follow this whole line of information. I think you'll find it fascinating. I sure have, anyway.
Yeah, I will do that. I will follow up on that. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry it took so much time.
No, thank you. Thank you.
I'll listen off the air then. Bye-bye.
Okay, yeah, take care. Yeah, it amazes me, Jim, the enigmatic nature of Gurdjieff's book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, in light, I think, of modern questions about aliens and such. Because the whole story of that book is he's living on Mars. And there's other beings on other planets of the solar system, and they visit the Earth, and they intermingle with people, and some of them become integrated into our society and so on. And
yeah.
It's very curious. And also the enigmatic statement that Gurdjieff once made, I think it's quoted in Patterson's book, where he says, like, I am small with those who sent me, something like to that effect.
No, but I don't think he said, I am a small man compared to those who sent me. It's funny, I just read that again in a book I've been reading lately. And again, this guy in this book was saying that he felt that Gurdjieff had made contact with the Quajagon, who are sometimes referred to as a Sufi order that existed in Afghanistan and may have actually been dispersed, but this guy sort of takes the position that when he's talking about the Sufism is that it's not really the Islamic esoteric aspect of Islam, but it's actually broader than that, and that everybody who is an esotericist is essentially a Sufi. But what he was suggesting was that Gurdjieff had made contact with these highly developed beings, and that so he was an emissary, much as he describes, you know, the emissaries throughout Beelzebub's tales, that he was an emissary of the school at the Quajagon order, and that that, you know, he was brought here this guy's take on Gurdjieff was sort of in terms of his mission was that Gurdjieff was brought here to prepare the way for something beyond his teaching later, which would make sense in a way with that quote. But I think that quote is so interesting. I'm a small man. I mean, he was obviously not a small man, but small compared to those who sent me, which is sort of recognized, acknowledging that, you know, that even if he was a teacher, or if he was a master, that there are different levels even beyond him, and that he was nothing compared to these higher levels, which is really, you know, fantastic to think of, and especially the more you know about Gurdjieff, the more fantastic it is. I had the same reaction kind of about Mars, is that in terms of Gurdjieff's story, you know, it's like, yeah, these, as you say, these extraterrestrials have been coming to the Earth throughout human history, and interacting and planting different ideas and different, you know, initiating different movements and initiating changes in different directions at various periods of human history. It's very interesting. I mean, I don't think you have to believe even that they were extraterrestrial in the sense of being beings from another planet, but maybe beings from another dimension. I mean, you know, that's another way of kind of interpreting it.
Yeah, there's so many enigmas. I mean, I don't know the answers. To me, this is one of the outstanding kind of puzzles in life.
Well,
To say
that you don't know, I think it's the beginning of, you know, of being open to trying to understand things.
Yeah. Yeah, that I agree. I try to like be open to considering all possibilities and consider everything, and one doesn't need to arrive at a final judgment. Like, we can just maintain that level of uncertainty and just abide in that uncertainty, which is what I feel I do around the questions of aliens and such. Especially though, you see how the evolution of spacecraft over the last 50 years, like if you look back at the early flying saucers back in 1940s, 50s, and they had the, you know, the classical kind of flying saucer shape, eh?
Yeah.
And then you look at what the modern ones, which I don't know if you've heard of these descriptions, but they're said to be absolutely massive, and they're more
yeah.
triangular. And have you heard of those?
Well, I've heard of different ones. I've heard of ones like really, really massive, but some circular, but some triangular too. Yeah.
Yeah. So what strikes me about it is a little bit that if these are aliens from another solar system, I doubt that, or from another galaxy, I doubt the evolution of their spacecraft would have occurred so quickly with their repeated travels back to the Earth. What seems far more likely to me is this is the evolution of the technology by these beings. You know, I mean, people often say the Nazis were exploring the UFOs, and some people say they made some attainments. And now we know how many of these Nazis came over to the States after the war. Eh? They estimate 6,000 to 10,000 Nazi scientists who went into NASA and the CIA and our police forces and military and everywhere, you know, into medicine and things like that. You know, so it's so hard to know what's underlying all of this, like the global conspiracy, you know, because it's like I mean, I'm a conspiracy theorist, and as a theorist, it's like there's so many possibilities, and there's so much to understand, because it's not just one or another group. This is like a complex, interrelated sets of, you know, elitists and criminals and so on. It's a very complex situation. So it is like theory in a way, and you try to find facts that support different hypotheses concerning the mechanisms of that conspiracy.
Yeah, or maybe it isn't. I mean, you know, I mean, my own point of view is that a lot of the things I hear about the New World Order and the conspiracy to dominate and everything, I just don't find the evidence at all convincing, and I think a lot of it's quite wrong. And it seems to me that times people are trying to fit everything into the same paradigm and trying to explain it. I'm not denying that there might be certain things that are indicative of certain realities. What I'm saying is that to see everything as an expression of the same kind of thrust to this late, this creation of this new world order, I just don't see it. I don't agree with that. I think it's quite wrong, and I think in a lot of ways, I think it really throws people off what's more important and what's really where the real criminals are. Like, you know, I don't agree with it. It just doesn't strike me as being plausible. Well, not a question of plausible. I just don't see the information that convinces me of these realities. And a lot of the theorizing, a lot of the history is, to me, is like, it's nonsense. I don't agree with it. However, like I say, the way I see it is kind of is like, at times it sounds to me like people are so busy trying to reduce everything to this one worldview that it confuses things. I mean, in some ways, I think people are right about certain things, but that they kind of overreach or overstep, you know, what's really established and what they really understand. And that's kind of like, that to me makes me really cautious about just sort of accepting, oh, well, you know, this is just another aspect of this. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. There's so many, like you say, it's so enormously complex that I think at the end of the day, the most honest thing to say is that you really don't know. I mean, I don't believe the conventional story about almost anything now. You know, I think it's like, I take, for example, I go from my own area of expertise and my own understanding of things in the history of psychology and the nature of the psychology of consciousness. I start with that and I see how most of what I regard as conventional thinking is completely wrong. You know, to me, it's like, it's just completely wrong. And even though people repeat the same things over and over again, it doesn't make them any more correct. It just means that how widespread mistaken ideas have been disseminated and have been accepted as truth. So, you know, like if you have that attitude about something that you really understand, you can certainly extend that attitude to almost anything and say, well, maybe everything about everything. There's like a thing in the Fireside Theater years ago about everything you know is wrong. And in a way, like that's kind of, I think that's probably true, you know. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like I'm just as skeptical about the veracity of the alternative explanations of things as I am about the conventional explanations of things, you know. And in the end of the day, I guess for me, like, you know, I have to be kind of really convinced through my own understanding of things before I'll sort of, like, sign on to, like, saying, well, this is what's happening. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, you know. Like, at the end of the day, the really wise man is the one who, I think, who says, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's true in ways, and other ways I disagree with aspects of it. Like, to me, the one inescapable fact, for instance, is 9/11 was an inside job. Like,
oh, I
buildings
agree with that.
Like that don't fall down in 15 seconds.
I don't have any problem agreeing with that. I know you totally agree with that.
And there are
hundreds of other examples of you know, false flag operations and misdirections like that. I mean, there's no disputing that. I would regard those as historical facts. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but, and then the implication of that kind of, because see, not only do you have that event, which is then completely distorted and the public is intentionally deceived about what really happened. But then what you see is that, oh, like the CIA and the FBI, all these people supposed to be fighting terrorism and like, oh, hey, you guys, like, what are you doing? like, don't you guys realize? Like, see, then the implication of that, it's because it's not just that event, but then what it is all these elected senators and House of Representatives and the police and the military, all these people who have gone along, at least, even if only complicit in their silence. You see, that's what makes it so overwhelming. It's like we got no police forces anymore. There's no one protecting the United States from terrorists. The police, the CIA protects the terrorists. Like, they are the terrorists, you know? Now we learn about how the CIA has done all these criminal things around all Central America, South America, Vietnam, Korea, all around the world over the last decades. You know, it's terrible. It's like we thought we were the kind of heroes spreading democracy and spreading the American way of life, but in a way it was all based on lies. It's so tragic, you know, and the American people are continually deceived about these things. You know, it's terrible. I just heard about the Vietnam War. You know, I knew 50,000 young American men and women lost their lives in that war. And then there were 200,000 with severe disabilities in that. You think of that, like a whole generation of young American men and women, eh? It's all so tragic, and it's always based on lies. Sorry, Jim?
Not to mention the 2 million Vietnamese who died.
Yeah, really.
That sort of goes overlooked from time to time in discussions about things. I read a thing one time. It's in Maryland. What's her name? I was going to say Marilyn Ferguson, but it's not Marilyn Ferguson. It's Marilyn, I'll think of it, a historian who wrote a book about Vietnam, and she, there's no citation for this, but she says in this book that, and this is a kind of a, it's a history, it's much more of a left-wing interpretation of Vietnam, and it actually has, she makes the argument that essentially that the United States wasn't protecting democracy in Vietnam, was actually the biggest hindrance to democracy in Vietnam, because they knew if there were fair elections that Ho Chi Minh would be elected, and they didn't want that. But she makes the claim in this book that Marilyn Young is her name, that as many American veterans killed themselves as died in Vietnam. Now, that's 50,000 people. I find that hard to believe. But even if it's 5,000, that's, think of that,
Well, I think that's true now. I think at the moment, the states have only lost 1,000 servicemen over in the Middle East wars. But I think the rates of suicide among servicemen, I think exceeds.
It's not 1,000. It's much more than that. In Iraq, it's way more than that. I know it's not 1,000.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
3,000. I'm not sure.
Something. I think it's over 3,000.
Yeah.
But I could be
But I think the American military now, they have this terrible plague of suicides, and they've got so many of these men on these psychiatric medications, which is, I don't think really helps them resolve the things they've been through.
Yeah.
It suppresses the symptoms more.
They won't take care of them when they come back, you know. It was the same with Vietnam. They sent these people over there, and then, you know, they had these horrific conditions when they got back in the VA hospitals. Like, if you ever seen Born on the 4th of July, about Ron Kovach, and the same with now coming back, you know, it's the lack of care and facilities. I mean, it was under George Bush, that they actually, cut the benefits for veterans, and they cut the funding for the VA hospitals, you know, for the soldiers who were fighting in Iraq. I mean, hard to believe, but not really.
Yeah, they're always facing, the vets are always facing problems getting, coverage. I mean, that happened, so many suffered from the inoculations, from the anthrax inoculations in Iraq, and
they're exposed to in terms of depleted uranium and
oil
fires, and not to mention, you know, post traumatic stress, which is a major. I mean, it's unbelievable.
And then you hear quotes like what people say about Henry Kissinger, kind of referred to soldiers as stupid, dumb animals who kind of serve. He actually used that phrase.
Really?
Yeah, stupid, dumb animals who served as pawns for the plans of the global elites, you know. It's really so disgusting.
He's a war criminal, so, you know.
Yeah.
A respected war criminal, but a war criminal nonetheless, you know.
He's a respected one. I mean, he won a Nobel Peace Prize. When they gave Obama a Nobel Peace Prize, I thought, oh, what's he done for peace? Like, absolutely nothing. So it's like maybe that's for what he is, a genocide he's going to commit in the future. Maybe he gets a peace prize first instead of having to commit genocide and then get it.
Yeah.
You can do it the other way.
He got one for not being George Bush, but that's a whole other story. But yeah, you can't take any of that seriously. Yeah, it's like Henry Kissinger's got one. I rest my case, you know.
It's just
very,
more
very,
of the
very,
farce kind of.
A very
simple
human being, if ever there was one. Yeah.
We were talking about so hopefully there is a circle of enlightened human beings here who on the light side, who are trying to help in our battles here. I really in myself feel that we're facing this critical period in human history. You know, when I had that period when I learned about 9/11 a couple of years ago, where I was kind of went into these kind of hugely expanded states and unusual experiences I had, and what it was funny what I felt at the time. I have for the last years, I always felt we've got to get through to 2012, and I've always had this idea that by 2012, all the assets of the criminal elites around the world would be seized by the peoples of the world, and it would pay off all the debts of all the countries on earth and get everybody back to zero. And it would, like, wow, what, can you imagine if the whole time in our society we had, like, truly responsible governments, and, you know, and the governments had control their own banks, and they didn't create unnecessary wars, and they didn't spend billions and billions on all this security and police state stuff.
No.
It's just such a waste of, no, we can't imagine
it.
No,
I can't imagine it. In fact, you know, no, I can't. No, it's impossible. I mean, it's not going to happen. I mean, this is the nature of the beast, you know. That's the way things are, you know. It's not going to change. Like, it's not going to change for a long, long, long time. I mean, it may be that we end up destroying ourselves. I mean, it's still a possibility, you know, that I just see things are so far down the road that I don't, you know, I just don't see it as being a possibility that these people will ever be brought to justice, you know. I mean, I think they'll be brought to justice, but not in this dimension or on this plane, you know. Like, I mean, they're all going to pay for this, believe me. I believe that, you know, that nobody gets out of jail for free, you know, that everything has to be paid for on some level in some way at some time. And that's the only thing. I mean, maybe people might accuse me of being, you know, believing in pipe dreams in that way, but I do believe that there's some sort of karmic retribution, and I do believe that on some level that all of our actions, you know, there's a statement the other side of it that Gurdjieff made to the fact that no effort is wasted, nothing done for good is you know, isn't paid for or isn't, you know, isn't rewarded, and I believe that, you know, I believe that, you know, as you sow, so shall you reap, you know, and that in the end something's going to happen to these people. I hope so.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I really also strongly agree with that. I mean, beginning because I definitely believe that we're multidimensional beings and that we end with our physical death. So that there has to be other worlds within which we can have continued existence. And all of the religious traditions, I mean, they all have the similar concept of judgment states and afterlife states where people make retributions or they suffer the hell-like conditions. Gurdjieff talked about how people have to be burnt down. It's like they become so distorted that they have to be broken down so that the elements can return into nature and be reconstituted.
Yeah.
But, I mean, one way or the other, I believe so many of these people, in a way, they do sell their souls. And so if they're at death, that they really are taken into underground realms. And they suffer the condition, like, they're in conditions which correspond to their own psychological makeup. So they become soulless beings. And I think they're drawn into those realms of being with other soulless beings. But yes, it is nice to pray that there be justice. I mean, I'm a double Libra, so to me it's so outrageous, my sense of human justice, what I see being done on this planet. And I just so pray to see justice restored. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Were you going to speak at all?
I like to imagine. I guess like John Lennon, imagine, you know, a world without religion and a world where that's what I like to imagine. I like to imagine these people actually being brought to justice on Earth in a physical way.
Yeah.
And then to heal the traumas of humankind. And that's what I see as the possibility of a new age. Otherwise, I believe we're slipping into a fascist worldwide police state, you know, where these people will cull the populations and do all these deviant things. But we'll see. It's a very exciting story.
only $1 billion to protect democracy in Toronto. I just cannot get over that.
Yeah, it's outrageous. It's outrageous. And why I don't see why the police services, how they've betrayed the public so much, and they can't see this themselves. That is disheartening.
They're like anybody else, you know. It's a political organization. I mean, you know, it's run by people who have power, who are connected to people with power. So, you know, it's like everything flows downhill. I mean, you know, it's all political. I mean, you know, just like the major, if you're the head of anything, you're a political animal, whether it's the church or the police department or the, you know, whatever, any organization, you're a politician, you know, by definition, you know, like you can't get around that. And that's where the influence, you know, runs across things that flows downhill, you know, everybody comes from the top. And if people open their mouths and question things, typically they get fired or told they're insane or whatever, you know. I mean,
it's so amazing too, because it all ties in so well to what's said in terms of human evolution in Gurdjieff and other traditions, this idea that there are these seven possible levels of human evolution. And how Gurdjieff says that normally people only sound the do, re, mi of their cosmic octave. And the do is a physical person, mainly physically centered and developed. And the re is the emotionally developed, and the mi is the intellectually developed. But he says very few people really develop those three sides of their nature and then attain to the fourth level, which is this awakening of self connected to the heart. So he says, like, that's the next step in evolution. And this idea of the in life, people are controlled by the three lower chakras associated with money, sex, and power. And you just see that among the world elites, like their unbelievable obsession with wealth and greed, like unspeakable greed that I can't imagine owning billions and billions of dollars and ever wanting more to fill my inner emptiness while there were people starving in the world and all these terrible things going on. Like, it's unbelievable greed by a sane person's logic. Money, sex, and power. And you just see that, wow, like you look at political life and like it is, it's like the, in a way, the worst of these lower types who only care about money, sex, and power, in a way, they conspired in obvious and subtle ways to ascend to power. And, you know, I see them as having held back human evolution on this planet. You know, and that's what I see as a critical thing. It's like humankind, we need this mass awakening and the heart to kind of bring about a new age, you know, so I'm still hopeful. I'm hoping by 2012, I just want to live that long. When I woke up to everything happening, I just thought if I get through to 2012, then that'll be nice. But anyway. Okay, so we've got 20 minutes here. I won't get back to this mystical creation according to the secret doctrine. Boy, I'm pleased I got through that book, Jim, and got another set of edits done on it. What a task that was! It sometimes, you know, with your writing, you just get bogged down, and it's just so hard to get through.
Yeah, it's just so incredibly difficult to. When you're writing something that complicated, your book is pretty complicated to say the least. There's no real formula for trying to express these ideas. You're trying to work in the best way to try to. You're overturning so many conventional ideas about things, and at the same time, you're trying to present new material. So it's not easily absorbed or easily. Readily understood, and certainly not the implications aren't understood, then it's hard to try to organize it to find the best way to organize it and present it. And it's kind of frustrating almost, because in the sense that you know that certain things lead to other things, but the hard part is kind of connecting them. And as you say, once you've written it in a certain way, then you have to go back and rewrite it or try to correct it or to try to make it more coherent, more concise. It's always very difficult. It's a very interesting exercise. But one thing about that is interesting. I'm sort of struggling a bit with my own writing right now on the problem of God's contracting universe, and it definitely helps you. The real value of writing about this is that it certainly helps you, clarifies in your own mind, and makes a more coherent and comprehensive your own understanding of all these things. It's trying to explain them to someone else and trying to really allow the ideas to develop further, like to realize that this is a wonderful thing about the esoteric ideas, is that they're constantly evolving, and you're constantly reaching new levels of understanding and new connections and making new connections in them and grasping things that escaped you before. So anytime you try to rewrite this material, you always do it from a different level than when you originally did it. And so you see new connections, you see new ways to try to write it. And that's part of the challenge of it all, is that you have to take what you've already done, and you have to realize that it's not final and has to be corrected, and at the same time it has to be done in a way that you can incorporate your new understanding. And I mean, it's interesting in your own book, you were mentioning the Heart Doctrine earlier. I mean, I don't know how many times you've wrote that book, maybe 12, something like that, and each time it is a little different. Let's say it's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It evolved over a 15 to 20 year period. As I learned more, I refined it more and brought it together more. And that's exactly what you described. That's what happened as I revised my book on God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. At points it was like I realized the whole teaching on a much deeper level. Especially this time understanding things about what she calls a Dayan Chohan, who are the builders, like the spiritual intelligences and the role of Fohat, connecting spirit to matter and things like that. Like, it's like these books, like Blavatsky's, you don't read The Secret Doctrine and understand what you've just read. Like, the first time I arrived at the end of it, it's like, wow, what was that? You know? And then that's just like the beginning of to study it. Just like with Beelzebub's Tales, like Gurdjieff said, you gotta read it at least 3 times, you know? And that's, as you understand more, then more and more is revealed over time. Yeah, no, I'm very pleased with the God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. It just took a lot longer than I'd wanted, and it exhausted me a bit. At the moment, I'm, before the end of May, I'm putting together an article for the Esoteric Journal. For Donna Brown is doing a review of the Heart Doctrine, I hope, in the summer edition.
Okay.
And she invited me to do an article. And I hope to do a two-part article, and the first part is just on, the article would be The Origins and Nature of Human Consciousness, and part one would be The Heart Doctrine, and then part two I'd like to do is on zero-point origins, to try to deal with each of those ideas separately.
I hope you send it to me so I can comment on it, because I think you should do that, you know, because I told you Donna asked me to do something about Gurdjieff too, and I was going
to. Yeah, I hope we get back to that. I was thinking that the other day.
I've been so caught up in my own writing, and also like I've just been doing so much freelance writing, you know, which is good, but it takes away from my time. Like I just want to get back. I want to finish this book, but I would like to submit, because I've actually, the part I'm working on right now is on trying to recount, I'm trying to explain how your model of consciousness developed, and I'm beginning with your introduction to the fourth way, and I talk a little bit about some of the basic ideas, most basic idea about ideas about consciousness, and how that consciousness has to be studied within yourself and has to be studied systematically according to Gurdjieff, and how the basic ideas that Gurdjieff says we have to observe ourselves systematically in terms of his teaching. You have to apply his ideas to your observations of your own consciousness and your own states of awareness, and you have to do that intellectually, emotionally, and physically. And then the idea of self-remembering, how you have to try to awaken and remember I am here at the various points as you go about your day, and to understand that when you begin to try to self-remember, that it makes you aware that most of your time is spent in states of waking sleep, where it's quite possible to think, act, and feel without being conscious of yourself at all, like that these are quite automatic manifestations of your psyche. And that whole basic idea that consciousness is not to be equated with the psychic functions, but which is something that is separate and which is can be compared to light, so that you can have more or less consciousness, in other words, more or less light illuminating your psychic functions. And those basic ideas, trying to get those across and then explain them in terms of certain critical features of the Gurdjieff material. But then I've been doing that, and I had done that before. I'd written all that section before, but I was trying to understand, what the best way, because the Gurdjieff system, it could spend chapters and chapters and chapters, so I'm really trying to distill things to its essence. And one of the things that I had thought about I was going to include, and then I thought I might not include, but it was what I was discussing earlier, is that the implications for us as psychology students in coming to a completely different understanding of what the nature of consciousness and about the nature of what it means to be human, that we are multidimensional beings existing in a multidimensional universe, and that somehow psychology and cosmology are implicated in one another and reinforce and complete one another. These are really radically different ideas. I was trying to understand trying to think about how to explain that. And one of the ways and the implications of all that, this fantastic teaching, one of the ways is to talk about Gurdjieff and what I was explaining earlier about how throughout human history these figures have appeared. And Gurdjieff talks a lot about the history of esotericism and how these different figures have appeared, and different spiritual teachers and different teachings that are connected with schools of philosophy or art or whatever. And trying to explain these figures in history and in a way, the importance of Gurdjieff is not so much in the biographical details of him, which are interesting in and of themselves, but more in the essence of what he was and what he was trying to do, that this is really opens one to an entirely different understanding of what the possibilities for human beings are. And in a way, he was a manifestation of what he was teaching, was that he was teaching that it is possible to transform our nature of, sorry, I just stepped on a cat, our normal waking consciousness and our normal level of being, and to realize these higher aspects of ourselves. And in a way, Gurdjieff, no matter how enigmatic or mysterious he was, he did embody that, and it's important to understand that and realize that. And so I realized that's really critical, and that he for us was really critical in introducing us to the whole idea of esotericism. And from him, it led to us exploring all these other figures and in the history of esotericism. And you realize there's this whole world of fantastic, absolutely brilliant teaching about the nature of consciousness, about the nature of reality, about the nature of all and everything, in Gurdjieff's phrase. And it exists side by side with contemporary knowledge, but so much it doesn't touch contemporary knowledge in any meaningful way. And yet, if it did, it would completely overthrow our understanding that we've arrived about the nature of ourselves and the nature of reality, that we've arrived through modern science, through conventional religion, through conventional philosophy. It's of the utmost importance to understand and to realize this. And it's like this light that you can shine on all of human knowledge, and it provides a more comprehensive and coherent and integrative approach to understanding ourselves and the nature of reality. So that's kind of, I don't even know how this began, but that's kind of what I've been sort of struggling with, is how do you say that, and say it succinctly? Because it really, in terms of your development of your model of consciousness, it was what we talked about a couple of weeks ago. The part of it is that is the thrill. Part of the experience is the thrill of discovering this new knowledge and these new ways of thinking about it. But a big part of it is to realize that you don't know. Like everything you've been taught, you have to sort of unlearn, or you have to suspend it and realize, oh, it could, in its own way, what I've been taught is right, but it's impartial, it's incomplete, so it's distorted or it's illusory in the sense that it's cut off to a more comprehensive body of knowledge, which puts it in its proper place and explains its place, in a more coherent and comprehensive fashion. So it's like this whole kind of fantastic revolutionary breakthrough in terms of our understanding of ourselves and the nature of reality, and our understanding about the possibility of what it means to be human and the possibility of what it means to perceive reality.
Yeah, there's a lot there. It is fascinating that when you study the occult teachings, you find out it's not at all the case that they're incompatible with modern science. It's instead, the issue is the interpretation of the facts of science.
Exactly.
It's just like when I think of how invaluable the study of the laws of 3 and 7 are. From a mystical point of view, you can study those principles of the law of 3 and 7, but then you can apply it, and you can apply it in science, and you see all kinds of instances that illustrate these concepts. So it's not that mystical teachings are incompatible with science, with the facts of science. It's more what they're incompatible with are this kind of superficial materialist interpretation of the facts of science. That's, and that is attached on to the facts of science as though the materialist philosophy is proven by the facts of science, whereas it's not at all. The facts of science stand on their own, and they're capable of being interpreted in different ways. And so that's what is so thrilling to me, is to realize what I see, I think, is the scientific basis for all these mystical spiritual teachings. And I think one of the keys to understanding that is these mysteries of the human heart, because the human self originates out of the heart. It's not a consciousness, never was produced by the material brain in the head. You know, that doesn't mean that we can't be conscious in our mind, in our heads, because we are. You know, blood flows there, and we're conscious of things in our mind. So we're not saying there isn't consciousness in the mind. We're just saying that a human being has this deeper, essential consciousness connected to the heart. And this has such profound implications for the whole modern study of psychology, and thereby with the study of spirit and soul. And so there's that idea, and then this idea of, like, in mystical teachings, all their views of how we come out of nothingness, and mystical concepts of the nature of the absolute, and how all that ties into quantum physics and modern ideas about vacuum genesis and creation from singularities. So you got a lot of these ancient mystical ideas about creation, which really have been validated by modern science.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that rabbi who in conversation with Jonathan Cott, you know, he says, oh yeah, you begin with the supernal point of light. And he says, yeah, the Kabbalists have proposed that for hundreds or thousands of years, and now science has arrived at the same idea, you know?
He's quoting from a 14th century Kabbalist, a rabbi, and he say, yeah, like, they knew this in the 14th century, you know?
Yeah. All these modern concepts, which instead of disproving mystical teachings, actually now provide us with a way of understanding what the mystics were saying. That's how I see it.
Well,
you know,
if you look at, if you just look at that book that Ken Wilber has, Quantum Questions, where he reviews the writings of the major theoretical physicists of the 20th century, and almost all of them well, all of the ones he quotes in the book, I mean, it's Einstein, Schrodinger, and Heisenberg, and Bohr, and, I mean, you know, Eddington, Jeans, they all come to a view, they all developed an interest to a certain extent in mystical teachings, some more or less, and they weren't saying that what they'd found had proved mysticism, but Eddington's statement is that really science can only go so far, and that in a way that science had proven that, what science had established suggested that perhaps mysticism was the only means of going beyond science. Like, he recognized that, you know. So, I mean, even, it's funny, like, all these materialist, atheist reductionists who run around propounding, their version of scientific naturalism seem to completely ignore the implications of everything that 20th century physics has established and that the greatest physicists have established. I mean, it's really odd when you read these physicists. I'm reading Werner Heisenberg's Physics and Philosophy right now, and I mean, you know, very much more sophisticated than these people like Dawkins who claim to represent science. Somebody like Heisenberg is light years beyond him in terms of his understanding of epistemology and the nature of reality, I think, than somebody like Dawkins.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, like, I'm lately have been studying the new kind of models of holography in physics. And these are really quite remarkable theories. I can't explain it to the audience, but some of the concepts are of there being a higher dimensional alternative space, and it's called anti-de Sitter space. And they imagine that if you had a black hole in this alternate de Sitter space, the activities of the black hole in higher dimensional space are rendered mathematically equivalent to the physics of part of superstrings and particles on different boundary conditions. Now, I can't explain this properly, but the whole concept that there's black holes in higher dimensional space, and these have spin properties, and their activities would be equivalent to material energetic processes on the surrounding holographic surfaces or spheres. Now, these concepts are brought in to try to integrate quantum theory and develop a model of gravity. And these are profoundly complex ideas. But in science, it's like they don't have a way of connecting how such bizarre ideas might connect to the actual phenomena of the world or of human experience. Whereas if you have Blavatsky's concept about, Blavatsky says that the laws of physics are based on holes dug in hyperspace. And her concept is almost like you have seven mini black holes in higher dimensional space. And these have spin properties. And the spin properties are imparted to the ether surrounding the black holes. And that creates material bodies surrounding a central zero point center. So if you have a Blavatsky model of metaphysics, you have a whole way of taking these new concepts in holographic physics and applying it to trying to understand a human being or a solar system and so on. I noticed we're coming right down to time here, so we should probably finish up, Jim. We'll get back.
Is that how everything adds up to nothing?
Yeah, everything adds up to nothing. That was Aleister Crowley's magical formula of the universe. Plus one plus minus one equals zero. Yeah. And it's like everything adds up to nothing, which is so profound.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And the other thing, I love the quote from Crowley where he says he realized the essential structure of existence. Nothingness with twinkles, he says. But then he says, but oh, what twinkles. So
that describes most contemporary politicians and world leaders.
Anyway, no, they're not twinkles. They're fallen stars.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, they're bad stars. Anyway, okay.
Okay, thanks, Jim. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, thanks to BBS, too.
Yeah, thanks, BBS. Encourage people, go to www.zeropoint.ca and order a copy of The Heart Doctrine. This is really a very profound book and deserves to be widely read. Okay, thank you all. Remember ourselves. Well, let's have faith, hope, and love and take back this world. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye.